5 to his sons. Now, Jacob has come to the end of his life, and we're coming to the end of our study in Genesis. And the son of Isaac, he inherited both the blessing and the birthright of Isaac through trickery. They both rightfully belonged to his older brother, but he had bargained away the birthright for a bowl of stew, must have been some good stew, and then tricked his father into the blessing. And now, coming to the end of his life, Israel, he has to attend to the disposition of his estate. Now, in subsequent years, people are going to write out their wills on paper documents, and they're typically read afterwards. Small public service announcement from the lawyer side of me. If you don't have a will, get one. It's a good idea. Now, I suppose as far as it goes, it's probably a whole lot easier to put down what you think of people in writing, die, and then they find out about it, rather than having to talk to them to their face. But Jacob, perhaps they didn't do written wills in the time, perhaps this was the custom of the time. So in this case, Jacob has begun to deliver his last will and testament to his heirs. Now, Jacob was the father of 13 children. He had 12 sons, who were the patriarchs of the tribes of Israel, and one daughter, Dinah. Now, Dinah's not mentioned in this passage in chapters 48 and 49, as women didn't inherit from their fathers. They received a dowry when they married. But Jacob's 12 sons came from four women. Now, we know the story of Jacob's labor for his uncle Laban. He had gone up to work for him and worked for 7 years to claim Rachel as his wife, but was tricked by Laban into marrying Rachel's older sister Leah. Jacob then worked another 7 years to claim Rachel. And each of Leah and Rachel had a maidservant or a handmaid. And Leah and Rachel gave their handmaids to Jacob to sire more children, just as Jacob's grandmother Sarah had given over her handmaiden Hagar to Abraham, from whose union Isaac's older half-brother Ishmael was born. Now, I can't find any account of Jacob's father Isaac ever having another mate, someone else from whom he had sired any children. So this, as you can see on the overhead, you can see Jacob in the middle and the various women who were the mothers of his children and who they were. Leah and Rachel were his two wives, and they were sisters. Zilpah was the handmaiden of Leah, and Bilhah was the handmaiden of Rachel. And this is the order of the birth of the sons. Now, last week, George Adema took us through chapter 48, when Jacob blessed the sons of Joseph, treating them each as his own heirs, and giving each of Joseph's sons a full share of his estate, the same as he gave his own sons. Now, a brief word about ancient inheritance customs. From what I can tell, the father of the patriarch of the family had three roles. First, he owned property. Jacob is described as being a very wealthy man in terms of the livestock he owned. Livestock was the currency of the day. It was a sort of capital asset producing products for trade, wool, milk, and more animals, offspring, and finally meat when the animals were slaughtered. The animals described in the wealth of the patriarch were typically sheep, goats, camels, and cattle. Horses were not a predominant animal, as they didn't really have the same income-producing potential, and in the hot, dry climate of the Middle East, camels were better suited for transportation, but also for hair and milk. Second, the patriarch was also the ruler of the family. The patriarch's word was law. Disputes within the family and the direction of how the family did things, that was up to the patriarch to guide the family. Third, the patriarch was also the priest or the moral leader, if you will, of the family. Cultural contemporaries of Jacob would have included Melchizedek and Job, both of whom had these roles within their respective families. Melchizedek was a contemporary of Jacob's grandfather, Abraham, but Jacob was only two generations removed. Now, the family blessing was more personal than the birthright. The passing on of this blessing would give purpose and honor and direction for the future of the family. Years before, God had promised to bless Abraham and subsequently the world through his descendants, Genesis 12, 1-3, and Isaac had received also a blessing from God, as had Jacob. Now, each of these things had to be passed along to the next generation. Abraham passed the roles of leadership and priesthood to his younger son Isaac, not the older son Ishmael. Isaac wanted to pass the birthright to Esau, the older twin of Jacob, but Esau, as I said earlier, had given it away to Jacob for a bowl of stew and then got tricked out of the blessing as well by Rachel and by Jacob. Now, as I said a moment ago, There's 12 sons here and one daughter. If everything had gone according to Hoyle, then Reuben, the firstborn son, would have inherited the roles of leader and priest, and he would have received a double share of the financial estate. But Jacob had other plans. Now, you recall last week when George Adema spoke about chapter 48, he had called in Joseph, one of his youngest sons, and then called in Jacob, his grandsons, Joseph's sons, and given them the blessing. Now he's calling in his other sons. Can we go back one? Thank you. Sorry, this is something I found online, and I thought it was appropriate for the sermon today because, well, the consequences of the decisions of Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Jacob, well, they're about to come up and confront them. So, well, if it isn't the consequences of my own actions. So Jacob called for his sons, and he said, "Gather around so that you will, so I can tell you what will happen in the days to come. Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel." Now, two things to note here. First, this is the first record in the Bible of a man prophesying. God had made declarations to people earlier, and God had given prophecies, but there were no prophecies given any of Jacob's predecessors. Jacob was the first one to prophesy, given the message by God. Second, note how he addresses his sons. He identifies them as the sons of Jacob, his old name, which means holder of the heel or supplanter or grasper. And as I just noted, Jacob was the younger son of Esau. Remember the story of when they were born and he was holding on to his brother's heel as they were born. But in Genesis 32, 22 to 31, we read the account of Jacob wrestling through the night variously with God, an angel, or man. It's different translations of the Bible have different words there. And as dawn was breaking, the one against whom Jacob wrestled demanded that Jacob release him, but Jacob held on, refusing until he received the blessing from the wrestler, the supernatural wrestler. And the blessing given to Jacob was a new name, Israel, which means to prevail. And when you look over the history of Jacob, you'll see things. When he was a younger man, he was a trickster. He tricked his father. He tricked his brother. Everything that he had gotten through deceit. The blessing he received that night of the wrestling was because he refused to give in. He prevailed. He did not give in. So he was given a new name by God, Israel, to prevail. And his use in this passage is interesting, at least to me. He identifies his sons as the sons of Jacob, and says, "Listen to your father Israel," the old name and the new name. So first he talks to Reuben, the firstborn son. Chapter 49, verse 3, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power." Boy, that sounds good, doesn't it? "Turbulent in the waters, you will no longer excel, for you went up into your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it." Now, word about the blessings of the firstborn, and this is written probably contemporarily, but time-wise later on, Deuteronomy 21, 15 to 17, in the Mosaic Law, describes the rights of the firstborn. Now, listen to this passage and see if you can identify the situation to which this might fit. If a man has two wives, let's say, for example, they're called Rachel and Leah, and he loves one but not the other, and both bear him sons, but the firstborn son is of the wife he doesn't love, when he wills his property to his sons, he must not give the rights of the firstborn to the son of the wife he loves in preference to his actual firstborn, the son of the wife he does not love. He must acknowledge the son of his unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double share of all that he has. That son is the first sign of his father's strength. The right of the firstborn belongs to him. It seems that when this law was written by Moses generations later, it was very much a reflection of Jacob's time. I'm not aware of other situations like this where there's two wives, one is loved, one isn't loved, and so on. But according to this passage, Reuben, as the firstborn, would have been entitled to both a double share of his father's wealth and would have assumed the mantles of both moral and legal leadership for the family. But Israel refused to pass these along to Reuben for his treachery. Genesis 35:22 notes, "And it came to pass when Israel had dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it." As I said a moment ago, Bilhah was the handmaiden of Reuben's aunt Rachel and the mother of two of Reuben's half-brothers, Dan and Naphtali. Yet Reuben had gone in and had sex with her. In 1 Chronicles 5, the writer of that passage goes on to explain that Reuben, while the firstborn, but when he defiled his father's marriage bed, his rights as the firstborn were given to the sons of Joseph. You recall that from last week, that the double portion inheritance went to the two sons, equally as they went to the other sons of Jacob. So he could not be listed, that is Reuben, could not be listed in the genealogical record in accordance with his birthright, and though Judah was the strongest of his brothers and a ruler came from him, the rights of the firstborn belonged to Joseph. So we see this division of the rights in the family. The double inheritance right went through Joseph to his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and the right of the firstborn, the leadership of the family, went to Judah. We'll talk about him in just a minute. But despite his sin and his recklessness, Israel did not disown Reuben. Approximately 400 or so years later, when Moses led the descendants of these sons into the land out of slavery and back into the promised land, then Reuben also received a portion of the land. He was still a son of Jacob. We're going to come back to that in a few minutes. Now, the next two sons are Simeon and Levi. And here's what this is what Jacob told them. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join in their assembly, for they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger, so fierce, and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. Kind of harsh words to get from your father on his deathbed. Now, Jacob's disappointment in these two sons stems from a murderous rampage among the people of Shechem recounted in Genesis 33. We went over this a few weeks ago. Shechem, the prince of the land, had coveted Jacob's daughter Dinah and had raped her. Simeon and Levi brokered a deal with Hamor, Shechem's father, and they said they would not give Dinah in marriage to an uncircumcised man. But if Shechem and all his men were circumcised, then they would give him Dinah as his wife. And they agreed. So all the men, Shechem, and all his soldiers were circumcised. And while they were recovering from that procedure, Levi and Simeon attacked them and killed them all, killed everyone. They didn't kill just Shechem, the man who had raped their sister. They killed all the men, every man in the village. And they took the women and the children captive and took all their possessions. Israel refused to give Reuben the blessing of the birthright of the eldest son because he had dishonored him. Simeon and Levi were the next two oldest sons, but their murderous conduct disqualified them too. Nothing much ever came from the tribe of Simeon. During Moses' census in Numbers chapter 1, There's two censuses recorded in the books of the law. First, we've got Numbers chapter 1. The descendants of Simeon represented just less than 10% of the population of Israel. Now, the methodology for all the statistics geeks out there is that these were the numbers of fighting men over the age of 20. And assuming that there's equal proportion among them, that would also represent young people and women in the families. So you can see that during the first census, there was 59,300 fighting men of the tribe of Simeon, which represented about 9.83% of the totality of Israel. By the time we get to the time of Joshua going into the land of Israel, the number of fighting men had diminished nearly a third of that, down to 22,000, and Simeon represented only 3.69% of the totality of Israel. They declined over time. Now, I have read the whole Bible over the years. I didn't read the whole thing all over again just to check on this, but I could find no account of anything ever coming from Simeon. There's no prophets, no kings, nothing. He was a sort of black sheep, sort of the family. And the tribe of Levi, the next brother, they redeemed themselves generations later. Moses and Aaron were Levites, and the house of Levi stood by the house of God and by Moses during the Golden Calf Rebellion, generations later. The tribe of Levi was entrusted with the priesthood of the house of Israel. They received no inheritance of land, but rather they were to be supported in their priestly role by the other tribes of Israel. But God didn't forget, and doesn't forget, and will not forget the tribes of Israel or his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All the way to the other end of your Bible. Go into Revelation and go into chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 3. Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. Then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. And the next few verses list the 12 tribes and say 12,000 from each tribe, including first the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, 12,000 from the tribe of Simeon, 12,000 from Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Despite everything that's going to happen to the nation of Israel between the time of Jacob and now, notwithstanding the division of the unified kingdom of Israel into the northern and the southern kingdoms, Judah and Benjamin in the south, the rest of them in the north, notwithstanding the dispersal between the Persians and the Babylonians, the lost tribes of Israel, the God that knows the name of every star in the heavens knows the descendants of every patriarch of Israel and has a plan and a purpose for them and will identify them in his own time. Now, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi were each disqualified by their own conduct from the role of leadership from the house of Israel. Now we come to Judah, fourth son, 49 verse 8. Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches down and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nations shall be his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. Israel designates his fourth son, Judah, as the leader of the family. As I said before, and as George Adema said last week, the double inheritance went to the sons of Joseph, but the right of leadership, the right of rulership, went to Judah. In Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, explaining this. Now the sons of the Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was firstborn, as much as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright is given to the sons of Joseph. For Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler, but the birthright was Joseph's. Israel's blessing of Judah is the longest of the blessings Israel gives to his sons, and his blessing is full of imagery and is perhaps the most transparent of them all. And don't worry, we're not going till 3 o'clock. I'm not going through all 12 sons. First, Jacob notes that Judah's brothers would praise him. The tribe of Judah would not be a tyrannical ruler, but a tribe looked up to and admired by the other tribes. That is, within the nation of that would come, the nation of Israel, the tribe of Judah would be admired and praised by the other tribes. His hand would be on his enemy's neck. That is, he would prevail over those who opposed him. And there's a double aspect prophecy here relating to the Messiah. In Colossians 2:15, the Apostle Paul wrote, "And having disarmed the powers and the authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them upon the cross." So the first triumph of Jesus, I suggest, is overcoming Satan through his atoning sacrifice of his life on the cross. As the Apostle John notes in Revelation chapter 5, all of heaven worshipped Jesus, the Son of God, and declared him worthy of praise and honor because he was slain, and by his blood he purchased for God people from every tribe and every nation to be a kingdom and priest to serve God. The second triumph is yet to come when Jesus physically returns to planet Earth and rules as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords from his throne in Jerusalem. Jacob's prophecy continues. His father's sons would bow down to him. This foretold the lineage of what would come through the time of David and his descendants when Israel would have a king, and that king would be of the house of Judah. Later, during the period of exile after the time of David and Solomon, Daniel was effectively the leader of Israel in absentia, and he too was of the tribe of Judah. We know that Jesus was of the tribe of Judah, genetically through Mary, his mother, and legally through his adoptive father, Joseph, who were both also of the tribe of Judah, but the family had split several generations earlier. Jacob continues his blessings of his son, Judah. You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? Now, note that Jacob does not describe his son as a lion, but as a lion's cub. Lions grow up to be lions, but Judah wasn't quite there yet. I'm just checking my slides here. The tribes, there we go. That's a lion, and that's a lion's cub. And there's a world of difference between one coming after you and another. The little guy's kind of cute, probably want to play with him, put him in your lap, you know. The other one will probably want to play with you and make you his dinner. Now, throughout the Bible, the only person ever identified as the culmination of this prophecy is Jesus. In Revelation 5:5, John the Apostle's account of his vision of heaven and God's revelation of the end of time to him says, "Then one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals.'" No one else is ever described as the Lion of Judah. Not David, not Solomon, no one else. Only Jesus. "The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nation shall be his." The leadership of the house of Israel was forever to be with the house of Judah. It would never pass to anyone else. Although Saul, he was the first king of Israel, and he was of the tribe of Benjamin, but he was appointed by the people contrary to God's will. And Saul was the only one of his family to become king. His son Jonathan never became king, and before Saul's death, David was anointed to be the king in waiting by Samuel. David, of course, of the tribe of Judah. Now, while I'm sure Pontius Pilate meant it in a mocking way, when he directed a placard to be nailed to the cross over Jesus' head, what did that sign say? "Behold, the King of the Jews." I'm sure he was, you know, saying, "This is what we do to the King of the Jews. This is what Romans do to..." But he was right. This was the King of the Jews. That's who Jesus was, through the line of Judah, the fulfillment of the blessing that Jacob had given through his sons. "He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes." Jacob's imagery here is kind of interesting. He notes first that Judah, the ruler of the nation, will tether his donkey to a vine, to the choicest branch. It evokes to me the imagery of Jesus when he enters Jerusalem, not as a conquering warlord on a horse, but rather as a peaceful ruler riding a donkey and its colt in coming in peace. The imagery also speaks to the prosperity that would come to Judah. Wine was a commodity in the ancient times. It still is today, when people will pay hundreds or even thousands of dollars for a bottle of wine. And good wine comes from good grapes, and good grapes from good vineyards, right? But Jacob's prophecy is that Judah will be so prosperous that vineyards, and even good vineyards, will be used as tethering posts for animals. Like, they're going to be so abundant that you'll just, "Oh, I need a place to tie up my donkey. I'm going to put it on this, like, Chateau Neuf de Pape vine, and that's where I'm going to tie up my donkey." He goes on in the balance of the chapter to describe the blessings on the other sons, but these blessings are shorter and a lot more cryptic, and I'm not going to go through them all. Some of them are, there's eight more sons. I'll leave it to you to read those blessings on your own. These are the chief ones that deal with the dissemination of the blessing, the birthright, and the rulership that belongs to Judah for the generations to come. The other piece, if you want to have a look at it, when Joshua and Moses divvy up the land of Canaan and assign it, there are some scholars that believe that there's linkages between Jacob's blessing here in Genesis 49 and who gets what land in the land of Israel when they return 400 years later. Now, having given his final blessings to his sons, he tells them of the final wishes, that he should be buried in Canaan in the same cave where Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and his first wife Leah were buried. And then Jacob died and was gathered to his people. Now, in a certain way, as I was preparing for this passage and thinking about the wishes of Jacob, how he treated his sons, and how the Bible treats the tribes of Israel going forward, it reminded me of, like it or not, the judgment seat of Christ. It's not a place. The judgment seat of Christ, don't confuse that with the great white throne. The judgment seat of Christ is where all believers will appear to give an accounting of what we've done during our time on earth. It is not a place for punishment and, George, you are bad, go to hell. That's the great white throne. The judgment seat of Christ is the accounting place where we receive rewards, and I expect we'll be told of the rewards that we have foregone because we didn't do something. We didn't pay as much attention as we should have. Now, just as Jacob's sons, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, had failed as sons, we believers can fail in our role as God's servants. But despite these sons' failures, Jacob didn't disown them. They lost out on rewards that could have been theirs, but they forfeited by their own actions. Like Jacob's sons, we can lose on rewards that Christ would have for us, but for our failures. But despite our failures, we are not disowned. The gospel message, the good news, is that we are saved by faith, not of works. Neither works before faith nor works after faith. Yes, faith without works is dead. But our salvation is not dependent upon what we do or how well we behave. It is our role as servants to give glory to God and to do His will. But our task for our salvation is to believe, and by believing, to prevail. Where have you heard that word prevail this morning? Israel. We are to be like Israel. We are to prevail. In John 16:33, Jesus told His disciples, "I have told you these things so that in Me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. I have prevailed." 1 John 4:4 says, "You are of God, little children, and have overcome them," the powers of the world, "because greater is He that is in you than he that is in the world." Like a 4,000-year-old wrestler, we are to prevail. Believe and prevail. So what's our takeaway in 21st century Canada from this passage? Actions have consequences. Reuben and Simeon and Levi each retained the blessings of their father. They were not disowned, but through their actions, they lost out on what could have been theirs. As Christians, God will not disown us. We will always be His children, but we can make bad decisions and suffer the consequences of those decisions, foregoing blessings and rewards that could have been ours. Second, God does reward faithfulness. Joseph and his sons gained a double inheritance that by custom belonged to his much older brother. But Reuben forfeited that inheritance through his disobedience, and Jacob gained it through his faithfulness to God, his faithfulness to his family. Third, God keeps His promises. There's nearly as much time between the lifetimes of Jacob and Jesus as there is between Jesus and us. But despite the passage of all that time, God remembered His promises to Jacob and to Jacob's blessings of his sons, and guided their descendants over 2,000 years to the fulfillment of those promises. And because God doesn't change, He will continue to fulfill His promises both to the house of Israel and to us who are grafted on to the house of Israel and the inheritors of the blessing. And there are prophecies. Some have been fulfilled already. Some are yet to be kept. But just as God has been faithful to His word to Abraham, He's going to be faithful and continues to be faithful in His promises to us. I'm going to close in a word of prayer, and then we're just going to sing the very last verse on the overhead of 203, "And Can It Be?" Thank You, Father, for preserving Your word for 4,000 years. We can read about the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We can read the stories of the sons of Jacob and gain a glimpse of understanding of Your character, of Your love, Your graciousness, and Your holiness. Strengthen us and be with us as You were with Joseph, relying on You for everything, and with Jacob, secure in our faith and in the finished work of Jesus for our time. Amen.